Their service, partly sunny, windy, warm, high today 76, winds up to 25 miles per hour. Right now, wind southwest at 9, 56 degrees Racine, 55 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're spending this portion of WGTD's morning show with writer Jared Yates Sexton about his much-discussed new book called The Man They Wanted Me to Be, Toxic Masculinity and a Crisis of Our Own Making. It is Mr. Sexton's contention that many white males across the country are caught up in what amounts to a self-destructive trap. That trap is an outmoded and misguided idea of what it means to be a man, of what it means to be masculine. And he sees this as a trap that can lead to tremendous pain. And this is something that he has seen play out in his own life. And hence the book that he has written, which is not only written with kind of the national full landscape in mind and recent political developments that he thinks is a very direct reflection of this, but also a very personal book about what he himself has experienced and the ways in which he has had to grapple with this very same trap. The book again is titled The Man They Wanted Me to Be, Toxic Masculinity and a Crisis of Our Own Making. And Yates Sexton, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Toxic masculinity is a term that is very much associated with you because of the way in which you utilized that term in a much-discussed piece that you wrote. Remind our listeners about that and take us behind that provocative term, which is really at the heart of your book.
Yeah, toxic masculinity, a lot of the times we intermix it with the idea of masculinity, but that's not at all what I'm trying to say. I think toxic masculinity is when men who are insecure about their masculinity or feel insecure about their self-worth will oftentimes act out in these very typically hyper-masculine ways, which is having overconfidence, being aggressive, being stoic and not expressing themselves, and in the end it hurts themselves and the people they love, and I think society as a whole. But how this whole thing started a little while back was this started with Donald Trump's infamous Access Hollywood tape, in which he said a lot of things about women and what he had done to them, and it made me realize, as he kept telling people that this was locker room talk, that it was certainly talk that I had heard in locker rooms before. This was a lot of shocking rhetoric that I had heard men say when they thought that there was no consequence when they're around other men. And so I started digging through the idea of masculinity, and I started to realize that this toxic masculinity that we're talking about is at the heart of a lot of personal suffering and also a lot of social suffering.
Tell our listeners what you experienced once this op-ed ran, titled Donald Trump's Toxic Masculinity. I think it's important for people to understand the dimensions of the response from those who were very much angered by what you wrote.
No, absolutely. And I've actually found since the release of the book that there's a lot of men who are still angry. I've been the subject of a lot of threats, a lot of harassment. And maybe the saddest thing about all of this is that it's obviously coming from insecure men who automatically fall back on these old tropes and abuses that we would see in a schoolyard, we would see in elementary school. And it's certainly how insecure men act. If they feel threatened, if they feel like someone is encroaching upon them or their identities, they lash out. And that's definitely played out in the wake of certainly that op-ed and my book that just came out.
So I want our listeners to understand, in a sense, how complex your book is. And I mean that in the very best sense of the word. I don't mean complicated as in that it's hard to understand or confusing in any way. I mean, it is brilliantly written. But this is a book in which you do something, I think, very intriguing by bundling together your analysis of kind of our overall landscape with your own very personal experience, the way in which you have experienced so much of this in your own life, starting with early childhood and proceeding into early adulthood. Talk for a moment about your choice to do that and how difficult it was to do that.
Well, after the op-ed was printed in the New York Times, I actually started to receive a lot of outreach from other men who were telling me that they had always felt alone in how they felt about masculinity. And in the book, I write a lot about how the expectations of masculinity aren't fair and they're unattainable. And so men feel like there's something wrong with them. The fact that they can't be perfect and invincible and unshakable all the time. And men grow up basically being reinforced all around them, the idea that they're supposed to embody these things. And in a way, we keep each other imprisoned by those ideas because we don't talk about them. So after I started receiving all of this feedback and all of this talk from men who told me that they had felt alone in it, I realized I was going to have to tell my story to let other people know that they're not alone in what they've gone through, and certainly that there are a lot of abusive pitfalls in this and a lot of personal pitfalls in all of this. And I felt like the only way to do that was to open up my own life, my own history.
Right. And in a very, very brief nutshell, explain to our listeners sort of the nature of that personal experience with this. I mean, just very briefly summarize the tumultuousness of your own personal life and especially your family life.
Sure. So I'm originally from Indiana, and I come from southern Indiana in a really, really small rural town. I come from a very poor blue-collar family. My family are mine workers and factory workers and prison guards. And one thing, unfortunately, that I had to go through in that time is because I didn't feel right about being stoic. I didn't feel right about not being creative. I was sort of outcast and subject to a lot of personal abuse. And a lot of what I'm talking about, physical abuse, verbal abuse, and emotional abuse, is actually pretty regular in the culture, especially in how we treat boys. A lot of the time, in order to, quote-unquote, toughen them up, we actually subject them to a lot of really awful abuse. And that's certainly what I went through. I went through a series of stepfathers who abused me and my mother. And basically, they had only learned to be able to express themselves through anger and violence. And so as a result, whenever they had trouble at work or they had trouble in their lives, they resorted to this toxic masculinity. And it's at the root of a lot of this business.
Right. I appreciate the fact that you give us some historical context in the sense of talking about some of the earlier efforts to kind of get at the root of this. And I'm especially intrigued by the point when you quote a psychologist by the name of Dr. Joseph Pleck, who apparently wrote, coincidentally the year you were born, a book called The Myth of Masculinity. A book, in your words, that presented what he called the gender role strain paradigm and upended a half century's worth of theory about gender. It argues that because gender roles are social constructs and thus impossible to fulfill, the inevitable failure to live up to them can result in psychological damage. That really lays out the case very, very clearly. But I want to ask you, why is it that just because these are social constructs, that what about that makes them then impossible to fulfill?
Well, so whenever Plex started talking about that, and certainly what's happened in the years after after that idea and that theory, is we have started to untangle the difference between genders in terms of biology and sociology and why people do the things they do. And one thing that we have found is that men are always performing their identity. They will actually take a test. For instance, everyone says that men maybe aren't as empathic as women, and so they'll take a test where they're testing their empathy. They will unconsciously undercut their own performance. So men will do this in order to maintain an identity. They'll hurt themselves. They'll do any number of things that are damaging for them. And so it's a behavior that's learned as opposed to just a natural biological function. And when you start to look at that and you start to look at the difference between what is ingrained and what is learned, it comes to a point where people simply can't live up to artificial expectations. Men can pretend like they're not emotional, but that doesn't mean that they're not emotional, and that eventually takes a really massive and dangerous toll.
Right. As a matter of fact, you point out the work of some expert that essentially discovered that baby boys tend to be more emotional than baby girls. So if anything, men are hardwired not in the ways that we traditionally think of as masculine, but are actually perhaps hardwired to in fact be even more emotional beings, but that somehow gets, in a sense, ripped away from them, and this other expectation is put in its place, an expectation which might be at odds with who they really were born to be or intended to be.
Exactly. And so what we have found is, like you said before, male infants are actually more emotional on the average than female infants. There's other studies that we found where the constitution of men in terms of how they deal with disease and how their health works are fundamentally weaker than women in that regard. But what we end up doing with socialization, and that is ritualized abuse, and that is telling men that they're not supposed to be emotional and they're supposed to be this, they're supposed to be that, patterning and abuse, eventually come to a point where those things are so ingrained that men don't even realize that it's something they've been taught. They believe it to be biological, and as a result, they behave in a certain way. And whenever they're unable to attain those masculine ideas, there's a really terrible recourse. And then a lot of times, people get hurt.
Mm-hmm. And of course, one of the things that was most painful for you is kind of this refrain that is so often heard in the lives of young boys: boys don't cry. And I think you do a beautiful job of sort of unpacking those three simple words, because when we say boys don't cry, we're not only talking about what we expect from boys, but we're also creating a hierarchy between boys and girls that places boys, in a sense, in a position of strength, of being stronger than girls. And that's perhaps the root of this patriarchal hierarchy that you think is at the root of so much of this misery.
No, absolutely. Boys are taught at a very young age that there are things that girls do and there are things that boys do. And boys are always told that they are in charge of reason and logic because they're not as emotional as women. And so as a result, they start thinking that they own reality in a lot of instances. And this can lead to abuse. This can lead to what we've termed gaslighting. It can lead to a lot of really, really bad situations simply because men are programmed with an inherent privilege of what their gender should give them. And when eventually they find that they don't get what they want, even though that is a lot of what our culture tells them, is that men are entitled to what they want. When they don't get it, there can be really terrible consequences. And because we teach men not to express themselves and not to communicate, the only way they know how to express themselves in a lot of instances is anger and violence. And so when that happens, when that entitlement meets disappointment, it can be really bad.
Mm-hmm. You are very close to your mother as she weathers one unfortunate marriage or partnership after another, and you are the target of abuse from a series of stepfathers. You remain close to her, and you are also very, very close to your grandfather. And at one point, you explained to us something very intriguing about how your grandpa and grandma seem to live out, in some respects, very kind of opposite gender roles to what you describe. Briefly explain what you think was behind that, because it's obviously important for us to recognize that not every man in America is trapped in this masculinity trap in the same, or do not all experience it in the same way.
Sure. What people would consider traditional gender roles in my family, in terms of my grandparents, was swapped. My grandmother was definitely the masculine presence in the house, and my grandfather was actually the emotional heavyweight for people. He was the one who supported the family. When somebody got sick, he would sit with them. He was very emotional. He wore his emotions on his sleeves, which was antithetical to the idea of masculinity, but he wasn't treated poorly because my grandfather was a hero in World War II. He was a decorated a veteran of World War II, and so in a way, he had proven himself to others that he was masculine, that he could carry out the masculine role, and as a result, the family let him be emotional and didn't give him a lot of trouble over it, but he certainly had to go through a rite of passage in order to own inherent emotions that anybody should have.
One of the things that is intriguing about your story is that you were a very intelligent young boy, and you saw that perhaps when you could go off to school, you might be able to escape all of this and begin a much better life, freed from the trap. In fact, that did not happen. Why do you think that was? What was it that, in a sense, kept you rooted in this masculinity trap, even when you were able to kind of find yourself in an arena where, at least theoretically, it might have been possible to really decidedly step away from it?
Well, in the book, I describe that whole situation as very much being when you're exposed to this idea of toxic masculinity, or when you're raised in this sort of hyper-masculine patriarchal environment, the programming more or less becomes ingrained, regardless of whether you know it or not. And so for men who are raised in that patriarchal environment, they have a very hard time shaking those toxic masculine traits. So if they find themselves at a crossroads, or they find themselves emasculated or in a crisis, a lot of the times they will slip back into the old behaviors that even they might know are wrong and harmful. So it's one of those things that once you're exposed to it, it's there probably for the rest of your life, and you have to keep a real look on it. So it's an odd thing that it stays with you, even though you think that you've overcome it. So for me, it was certainly falling back on a lot of the old programming and the old things that I had been told and that had been taught to me through abuse.
What would you say to someone who would suggest that it is possible for somebody to live, in a sense, let's call it, a traditionally masculine life, replete with kind of these trappings that we have been talking about, and yet not succumb to kind of the central trap of emotional unavailability or masculine brittleness, which is another thing that you describe. Would you acknowledge that such a thing at least occasionally occurs? Or do you feel like just about anybody who, in a sense, subscribes to what we might think of as very traditional ideas of masculinity are almost inherently, inescapably going to find themselves in this trap that you describe?
I think there's certainly a difference between masculinity and toxic masculinity. I think a lot of the traits that we look at, such as the idea of the protector or the person who takes care of the rest of the family, like and loyalty and strength, those are, and bravery, I think these are all good things that come with the idea of masculinity. So I certainly believe that people can be masculine without succumbing to the ideas of toxic masculinity. And I think in part the reason why that's possible is because masculinity or toxic masculinity is, on its face, a complete contradiction. We tell people that men are supposed to be strong, but we look at statistics and we see constantly that men are terrified of going to the doctor. They're terrified of seeking mental health help. They're terrified of expressing themselves. And so that terror that they're holding is in complete contradiction to what the idea of masculinity is supposed to be. So I think when someone is brave and they're brave enough to be able to do those things and to express themselves and have healthy relationships and healthy goals, I think you can totally have a healthy masculinity, but it's when those completely unattainable ideas take hold. I think that's where the whole thing starts to fall apart.
Your book does not shy away from some very strong statements about our current president and about what his presidential campaign tapped into. At one point, you talk about Donald Trump's appeal being based in his ability to mimic the anger that was in the heart of so many men who ultimately cast their vote for him. Talk about that anger and about what you see as Donald Trump's mimicry of that anger.
Donald Trump, I truly believe, has taken advantage of a weakness in American men, especially their insecurity, their feeling that the economy is changing, that the country is changing, that demographics are changing. So there is an emasculation that I think a lot of men feel right now, and they needed somebody to step up and to express that. And I think Donald Trump has done that by appealing to people and telling them that their old jobs and factories are going to come back. The coal mines they worked in are going to come back. The American economy is somehow or another going to be rewound into the past for these men to have the jobs that used to identify them. But the truth is that those jobs aren't coming back, and that the men didn't enjoy those jobs in the first place. So what's actually happening is that men are being told that their old lives that weren't good for them, that broke them and their bodies, are going to come back even though they never will. And I think he's taken advantage of a lot of insecurity among white men who feel like their place of power is in trouble and endangered. And I think that is one of the primary reasons why Donald Trump enjoys the support and the base that he does.
Right. You write at one point, they are justified in feeling that something has changed. The world really is transforming around them. And with those changes, their advantages are rapidly evaporating. I think that points to what you sometimes hear from certain men in the far right who really balk at the idea of white privilege. I mean, how am I living a life of white privilege when you know there are so many things about my life that are a struggle? But I think you're pointing to a whole system of advantages that are beginning to, in your word, evaporate, and they need help. We all need help with contending with that vast sea change in our society.
Absolutely, and in particular with the economy, what has happened has been revolutionary. In the past, when it relied on industry, which is where men would step in and supply the labor based upon their bodies, they were taught that they were supposed to be cogs in a machine. They weren't supposed to complain about aches and pains, and they were supposed to devote their body to the pursuit of their labor. Now the economy really rewards what used to be gendered as, you know, female traits. Like the new economy, it promotes communication, collaboration, and invention. And these are things that men are taught that they're not supposed to be concerned with. So the economy is absolutely leaving behind the old ideas of masculinity. And so that's leading a lot of people to look for a return to traditional ideas, even though back then they had to give their bodies to their labor. And I definitely see that it is a place where people are frustrated, where they feel that personally they do not have privilege, but that societal privilege is definitely working against them in this case.
As you probably know, it's not all that likely for the conservative men of that little town in Indiana where you grew up to take your book in hand. Who did you write this book for? And what good do you see springing from it?
Well, you know, I at first was really hoping that there were going to be people who maybe read this and disagreed with me and sort of found something that we could agree on. And I was really afraid that I wasn't going to find that. But as I've been talking to men, there's a lot of men who have told me that they picked up this book looking to hate it and that they disagreed with my central thesis. And they read through it. And I think the one thing that they ended up having to admit is that they knew deep down that they were performing a role that wasn't real. And it was uncomfortable and it didn't fit them. And it had always felt uncomfortable and like it didn't fit them. So I've actually, I think, had a lot of success being able to talk to men who might think that toxic masculinity is an invented, politically correct term, but have actually found a lot of themselves in the book. So I wrote it in part for them. I wrote it for people who love men that maybe they don't understand or they haven't been able to reach, and they would like to have an idea of how they came to be the person that they are. And I also wrote it for 13-year-old me, who I think really could have used a voice that told him that he wasn't that strange, that there wasn't something wrong with him, and that all men feel uncomfortable with these ideas. So I really hope that maybe there are some people out there who felt alone. I know that a lot of them reached out to me after the op-ed and after the book has been released. So I really hope that maybe in some way it opens the door for a couple of people.
Jared Yates Sexton, his book is The Man They Wanted Me to Be, Toxic Masculinity and a Crisis of Our Own Making. The book is published by Counterpoint. 8:36, and here's a second interview from the Morning Show Archives to finish out today's morning show. This book is about golf, but about much more than golf. The book is also about a father and a son and their relationship and a promise which the father was determined to keep with his son, a promise that if his son, Jack, ever became accomplished enough at the game of golf that he became a pro, then the father would be his caddy. The father is Don Snyder, a gifted writer, and the book at hand is called Walking with Jack, A Father's Journey to Become His Son's Caddy. Don Snyder made the decision of picking up stakes from his comfortable home in beautiful rural Maine and took himself to Scotland to train extensively in all the fine points of being a caddy. And it was a difficult thing to do, but also an immensely rewarding experience on many, many different levels. And in fact, Don Snyder did come back to be the caddy for his son, Jack, during his, albeit short experience, short tenure, as a professional touring golf pro. And the book that Don Snyder has written comes on the heels of a number of other books he's written, including The Cliff Walk, A Soldier's Disgrace, The Winter's Travelers, A Christmas Fable. And this book, published by Doubleday, is again called Walking with Jack, A Father's Journey to Become His Son's Caddy. Don Snyder, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you very much, Greg. It's good to be here.
I'm very, very happy to be talking with you. So this book is not only about the relationship you have with your son, Jack, but it is also, in some respects, a book about your relationship with your own father, John, a relationship which was difficult in many, many ways, although the two of you were able to come together in a sense, reconcile not long before his death. You write this book with disarming honesty about your relationship to your dad and also about the relationship with your son Jack, which was a devoted relationship and yet also one that could be very rocky, and you don't go out of your way to paint anybody in especially positive terms. This is a warts and all honest kind of memoir. Can you tell us about the decision to be so honest in writing about such personal matters? Was that a difficult thing to do?
Well, Greg, you know, as a writer, you're trying to get at an important truths. That's what I've spent my life doing. And when I was raising my son, just like with my daughters, I mean, these are love stories that we have with our children, but like any love story, they have their share of joys and sorrow. Now, you know, you hold these little children when they're first born as babies, and you think you're going to have them forever. And then there's a moment or a glance across a room when you see that they're going to go on in this world to be their own people, and they're going to leave you behind, in a sense. And with my son Jack, he was 5 years old when I sawed off a golf club and put it in his hands in the backyard. And he hit the first ball I set down, and he hit it so well, it just dawned on me in that moment, he's going to leave someday and have his own life. So I said to him, hey, look, if you ever get good enough at this game to make it to a pro tour, I'm going to be your caddy. Now, I said it because as a father, I just in that moment wanted to walk with him as far as I could in this world. And then, you know, as he became a teenager, and he began to sort of despise me the way all teenagers, I guess, have to despise their parents. Whenever he'd get really mad at me, I'd hold it against him. I'd say, hey, Jack, don't forget. Someday we're going to meet up on a pro tour, and I'm going to be your caddy. And he'd go, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then he left home. You know, 3 days after he graduated from high school, he goes off to the University of Toledo, the only school in America, Division I school that would give him a chance, makes the team as a walk-on. So it was time for me to step up, and it was the winter here in Maine in this little town on the marsh in Scarborough, Valentine's Day. I flew over to Scotland. I took up residence in a little town outside of St. Andrews. I mean, I don't know where you'd go in this world, Greg, if you're going to be a chef or a race car driver, but if you're going to train to be a caddy, there's only one place, and that's Scotland. And I went over there, and I took 2 months to get into shape at age 58. I walked two rounds a day with my golf bag filled with rocks from the shore of the North Sea. And then I presented myself at the number 9 ranked golf course in the world, which was King's Barnes in St. Andrews. And the caddy master there, a wonderful Scotsman named David Gilchrist, said, well, here's the deal. You'll be my oldest caddy. But if you're willing to work 187-day season straight without a single day off, and if you never say no to a second loop when I need you, I'll give you a chance. And so I did. You know, after spending 35 years locked in rooms writing books and movies, I was outside walking this beautiful ground. The Scottish boys took me in instantly because they honored this mission that I was on, you know, to learn all I could so I could one day caddy for my son if he made a pro tour. And it was like a privilege every time out there with these golfers from all over the world. They come there blind. They don't know the ground. You learn the ground so well. You're shepherding them past the hazards to the good ground, which it dawned on me early on is exactly what we do as parents with our children.
Mm.
But I have to say this, Greg. I did not intend to write a book about this until something happened early on in my tenure, in my first season there as a caddy. I was out there one day with a father and son. Just another father and son making the trip of a lifetime, you know, to Scotland. But this man in his mid-50s had been struck with multiple sclerosis, and he was losing it. He told me that on this trip, he knew that this was the last time he was ever going to get to do something like this with his grown-up son. And I had to actually help him onto the greens. He would hold onto my arm to climb up onto the greens. And at the end of the round, like so often happens, they ask you to take a picture of them, and I was taking their picture off the 18th green when I saw the son reach up and touch his father's face, and it hit me. He was brushing his father's tears away. And in that moment, I thought, you know, I'm going to take really, really good notes, and someday I'm going to write about this.
Mm. You obviously knew the game of golf very well, and I'm trying to remember, were you yourself a golfer?
I was not a golfer. I knew it well enough to teach my son, only to a certain extent. Then I turned him over to other people. But I understood the game. You know, it's an odd, interesting circumstance, Greg. I spent a lot of time writing screenplays. I wrote one movie called Fallen Angel, which has become Hallmark Hall of Fame's most requested Christmas movie each year. And everything that happens in a movie is cause and effect. What happens in this scene was set up by what happened in the scene before, which is exactly the rhythm of a golf game. When you find yourself standing in a bunker to hit a ball, it's because of the shot that you took before. And when a good caddy will figure out a way to plot his golfer around a golf course, you know, in the most effective manner, just like writing a script.
your son, was golf his only sport?
No, and
at what point did golf become the predominant interest for Jack?
Well, he played hockey and he played baseball as well. He was a good athlete. About the time he became a freshman in high school, when he was clearly, you know, one of the best, if not the best, in the state of Maine. First of all, he's a big kid, you know, 6'4". He can hit the ball a mile, and so much of the, you know, the contemporary golf game is about distance. And he just had the personality for it. You know, he's the kind of kid you could hit him over the head with a 2x4, and he just sort of take it in stride. That's another thing you learn in golf. Golf, it's a very unique game, Greg, as we all know, but why is it unique? First of all, you have no opponent. It's just you against the ground. And secondly, you spend most of the time walking. And that's a plague to most golfers because it's too much time to think about the shot that you just missed or the lousy round that you played last time out or the fact that you had a great round going and then you just made a terrible score on a hole. But Jack is not made that way. When he stepped up to a shot in golf, it was a whole new world. Nothing that happened before was in his mind. He really had the right temperament for it.
Hmm. So your son does, as you say, manage to get into a college that allows him onto the golf team and enjoys some success, which sets in motion the process by which you take yourself over to Scotland in order to train in the art of caddying. So what were some of the things that were most important for you to learn in terms of the function of the caddy beyond what is the most obvious? It's the guy who carries the bag, carries the clubs. Obviously, there is a great deal more to it than that, particularly when we are talking about the elite level of the game. What is it that the rest of us do not see that is so vital in terms of the role that a caddy plays?
Well, here it is, Greg. That's a great question. I mean, there's 102 things. I made a list once. There's 102 things you can do wrong on a golf course with your golfer, from the most obvious, from forgetting which ball is his, how he's marked it, and you end up hitting someone else's ball, to misreading a putt, to standing with your shadow falling over his line when he's about – I mean, there's 102 things, which I won't go through all of them. But the intrinsic relationship between a caddy and his golfer, and this is something you all of your listeners would have seen. Anytime you watch an event on television on the PGA Tour, there's always a moment where the golfer loses his or her belief in himself. That's just the nature of the game. You saw it with Phil Mickelson in the U.S. Open. That is when a good caddy who has earned, the trust of his golfer. You earn the trust of your golfer, and then you step in those moments when the golfer has stopped believing in him or herself. And you are the one who instills in that person the confidence to make the next shot. This is all stuff that you learn when you're caddying in Scotland, when you're out there every day with people that you've never met before. You learn to very quickly calculate their strengths and weaknesses after like two holes, and then hold in your mind a way to get them around the course so they play their best round. And it involves trust, a mutual trust. And that's really, to me, that was a sacred thing, because to have the chance each day to go out and earn the trust of a stranger in this world we live in now where there's so little trust left, I really felt that it was a privilege. Now, you have to understand, when I went down to caddy for my son Jack on his first pro tour, the Adams Tour in Houston, Texas, in the winter of 2012, and we lived together for 4 months in one motel room without killing each other, that took some trust right there. But I had to forget that I was a father. Jack did not need a father out on the pro tour standing beside me, and I had to forget that this was my son and just pretend that it was a golfer. Like all the golf, it was interesting because in Scotland, every round I caddied with a total stranger, I pretended it was my son, and I was out there. That's why I was out there fighting for every shot with these people. But then when I got to Houston, I had to set aside my role as a father and just be a caddy and concentrate and bear down on all that the Scottish caddies had taught me, particularly about the trust.
Mm. And I find it really fascinating because, of course, what we typically see on the Pro Tour are long-term partnerships, or at least we assume that that's how it happens most of the time, long-term partnerships between a given pro and their caddy, and a relationship which is on the one hand professional and on the other hand probably becomes deeply personal, especially over time, versus the experience you had at St. Andrews in Scotland, where you were caddying essentially for a different golfer every single day and did not build up that kind of long-term relationship with anybody at all. And it's interesting to think about how vastly different those two kinds of experiences are, and yet at the heart of it is the same role that a caddy is to play, whether That's it's right. for your own son and someone you know deeply, or somebody who you have just met and will never meet again.
That's right, and I have a couple of pals who are caddies on the PGA Tour who've said to me, I couldn't do it. I couldn't go out there every day with a stranger and have to earn the person's trust, you know, each time out, and in a very short time if you're going to have a successful round, so that you're working together and it's a collaboration. But you get good at it. It's like a blind date. You meet this person on the first tee of the old course, and you're going to spend the next 5 hours with them. And if you've done your job well, by the time it's over, you're best friends. You got to remember, there's also the punishing weather, the malevolent weather over there. So it's like a survival. Golf in Scotland really is about two things. It's a test of endurance and a lesson in humility. And I don't care whether you're the biggest prince on Wall Street. When you're over there in a 40-knot gale and the rain is coming in sideways, and you're just struggling to make each shot, you need all the help you can get. So if you have a good caddy, that's a big part of it.
We're speaking with Don Snyder, talking about his book, Walking with Jack, A Father's Journey to Become His Son's Caddy. By the way, is the game of golf itself played at all differently at a place like St. Andrews versus on the typical American course?
It's very, very different, Greg. Golf in America is played in the air for the most part, these beautiful towering wedge shots. Yeah, those shots would be ruinous in Scotland because of the wind. It's played on the ground. The contours of the ground, the mounds, the hollows, the troughs that run along the ground, you get to know them as a caddy intimately because that's how you have to make your shots, low shots that run. So one of the first things that happened to me over there was one of the old Scottish caddies took me aside and said, if you want to know how to be a good caddy on this ground, go out tonight after the course is empty. You know, it stays light in Scotland till like 11 o'clock at night. Go out there and drop a ball on the first tee and kick it all the way around the course to the 18th green. That's how you learn the contours of the land. And I did that. And I did that with every course that I caddied on. And then down in Houston, I did the same thing before we played each course.
While you were in Scotland, you lived what I think you describe at one point as on a monk's budget. That is, you had very little extra money. You had no television. I mean, it was, for the most part, a life of some deprivation. How significant do you think that was, if it was, to the whole experience in terms of what it ultimately meant for you? The fact that you were doing this not in the lap of luxury with comforts on every hand, but in a sense living a daily life of some desperation, or not desperation, but deprivation.
Right. Well, all caddies, you know, caddies are, I describe them as, you have to have the heart of a sled dog. I mean, first of all, you have to understand I had three daughters in college, so I need to earn every penny I could and send it home. I couldn't go out to the pubs at night or anything like that. I lived on two peanut butter sandwiches. I walked 10 hours a day on two peanut butter sandwiches and a thermos of tea. And I had a bowl of soup and two hard rolls every night. And then for breakfast, a bowl of cereal and a glass of orange juice and a cup of coffee. That was it, period. And I mean, the standard day for a caddy is, you know, I get up in the morning, I walk a half a mile to the bus. I'm already soaked by the time I get to the bus. The bus takes me to the golf course. I walk a mile from the bus stop to the golf course. I'm soaked again. I go out on my first round. Your shoes are filled with rainwater in the first hole. You're out there for 5 hours. You're so cold you can't feel your hands or your face. You finish, and you're just about to go into the caddy shed for a cup of tea, and the caddy master is pointing to the first tee. There's another group ready to go out. So now you've got five more hours out there, freezing cold. Now it's the end of the day. You've already put in, counting the time it took you on the bus and everything, you've put in a 12-hour day. You walk a mile back to the bus stop in the rain, usually. You get there, and you see the taillights of the bus disappearing, and you got to wait another hour for the next one to take you home. So you literally get inside your door, you strip off your wet clothes, you eat a bowl of soup, and you fall asleep in the chair, and you get up and you do it all over again. You just do it day after day after day. And, you know, 187-day season, there were only 17 days when I didn't either wear my long underwear or take my long underwear, and that's through the summer. So, there's a strange thing. I mean, I had the advantage of every time I got discouraged, I could just say, okay, someday I'll be caddying for Jack in the sunlight, and all this will be worthwhile and make sense. But you admire the guys over there who've been doing it for 20, 25 years. They are very, very tough. They're great guys, very tough.
Speaking of tough, while you were at St. Andrews, you had to field the sad news or disappointing news from your son at one point when he was dropped from his college golf team because of academic struggles. That could not have been an easy experience under any circumstances, but I should think especially difficult given how far away you were geographically. Can you just say a word about that particular experience?
Exactly, Greg. Yeah, Jack had done so well as a walk-on to make the team at the University of Toledo. He played in the big NCAA tournament and did so well. And then, you know, he made the mistake of not bearing down on his studies, and he was dropped from the team. And I was not going to go back for a second season, but when I saw him again, I saw that he was giving up on himself, and I went back for a second season in Scotland just to show him that I was still with him, you know, that I had not given up. And that's what we do as parents. We have to step in when we see our children, you know, losing their belief in themselves. And so it all worked out well in the end. We met up on the Pro Tour in Houston, and it was really a privilege. The whole thing was a great experience.
As you wrote this book, one thing that is kind of interesting is the tight focus on yourself and your son, and to some extent you and your own father, John. We don't hear an awful lot about your wife or your daughters. I wonder to what extent that was a conscious decision for you as you wrote this story. I mean, obviously they weren't central players, and yet, of course, they're part of the family and were very powerfully affected by all of this. I wonder if you could just say a word about the role that they played in all of this, and also the role they end up playing in the story as it's told in your book.
Well, they're, you know, two of my daughters were already off at college. They had their own life, and Kara and Colleen, my wife Colleen, were at home, and everybody was very understanding, that's all I can say, and patient. They knew that I was on a mission and it was important that I complete it. I didn't write much about them in the book, to tell you the truth, because I couldn't bear to think about them. I missed them too much. I mean, there were times in these little villages that the bus would roll through, I'd see someone who looked like Kara or looked like Colleen or one of them, or Neil or Aaron, and I wouldn't even look at them because I was, you know, you can really get homesick in a situation like this. And I really tried to just keep my focus on, you know, on Jack and on golf. And, you know, you can lose yourself in the game of golf. It's merciful in that way. It is a ruinous game. As I said, I call it a leaking ship of dreams. But it also has a way of inhabiting you and taking over your world. So you can miss your family and step onto the first tee and then for the next 10 hours not even think about them. Not about anything but the game at hand and making each shot. So I had that advantage with golf.
Mm. How does Jack look back on these events? And is it with any regret, or does he feel as good about all of this as you do?
Well, Jack just spoke to me on Father's Day, and he said again, he sent me a little card too. He said, thanks for helping me chase my dream. I mean, he doesn't have to go through the rest of his life wondering if he could have done it. he knows now. He went down there and did his best, and, you know, he proved to himself exactly where he stood in the game of golf. And as for me, as I said to him as we were climbing onto the first tee of the first event on the Adams Tour, I said, Jack, I've had a chance to do a lot of cool things in my life, but this is the coolest, so thanks for bringing me along.
Hmm. The book is Walking with Jack, A Father's Journey to Become His Son's Caddy, published by Doubleday. The author